From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Ordinarily, it would be myself, Grant Williams, my partner in crime, Roger Mitchell. Come in, Roger, you there?
Hi, I'm here, yeah. I'm here, yeah.
Good.
Somebody else isn't.
And our resident pirate, the captain himself, Giles Morgan. However, we have a slight, I think we'll call it a technical hitch, shall we, Roger? Because our resident pirate is marooned in the Solent on a boat which has run out of gas. Which is just the most wonderful news that either of us have had for a long, long time. So, Giles, hopefully you're listening to this from the shore, because by the time we edit this and put it out, if you're still stuck on the Solent,
then, it's a problem.
It's a problem. But I if I were you, I'd throw Paul overboard and
blame Paul,
strangle
absolutely.
The parrot. That's what I thought.
Yeah, the parrot, the dog, or whoever it is.
Yeah, all of them. Get rid of them all. Throw them all overboard.
Yeah.
Anyway, Roger, so we will have to make do without the captain this week.
Big shame. Yeah.
Big shame.
Forward
but
to
we will miss him. But anyway, never mind. The show must go on, as they say.
Yeah.
And this week we have a guest joining us, and this is a guest I've been looking forward to speaking to for a long time, because this is I'm willing to go out on a limb before we record this, Roger, and say that this is likely to be one of, if not the most controversial guests we've had on the show, because he's a man about whom everybody has an opinion. I mean, period. You can't. He's like Marmite. He's Marmite in person. You either love him or you hate him. He's been a big part of not just sports media, but media in Britain for 40 plus years, has been incredibly influential during that time. And most recently, on talk radio, and there was a great piece, perhaps we'll link to that, Rog, on the Twitter page, where he came out talking about the Charlton situation, which I'm sure we'll get into shortly.
Yeah. Well, today we've got Kelvin McKenzie, famously editor of The Sun in the glory years of that newspaper, who then went on to found what is now known as TalkSport, and that kind of more laddish type approach to sport and less broadsheetish, which I think is probably in character with his whole career. I met Kelvin at the end of the 90s when he came up to try and buy my Scottish Premier League radio rights, and we kind of like hit it off in a kind of like, you know, no punches pulled way that we've always had. Kelvin is, I find, one of the most intelligent and astute people that have inhabited the media sector in the last 30 years in the UK. That doesn't mean that he's a saint. It doesn't mean that he hasn't made mistakes. I just think that, you know, in the kind of program that we have, sometimes you have to bring information from all points of view. Today we won't talk about Hillsborough. We won't talk about Ross Barkley, because our style, I think, Grant, is that we are the tavern of sports discussion, where guys in a pub talk like they would without accusing each other or it being hard talk. I think that's my view about how we do this. It's how, you know, I set it up with Kelvin. I'm sure a lot of people won't be happy with that, but I think that's the way that I would like to do it, mate. What do you think?
No, I'm fine with that, Roger. I mean, as I said, this is a guest that we want to be comfortable and we want to be able to talk about stuff, and so I think it's important that we create that environment, as we always try and do. So we'll just see where we go with it.
Yeah, so no further ado, welcome Kelvin McKenzie to Are You Not Entertained? Thank you so much for doing this.
No worries.
I'd like to introduce you to my partner in crime today, Grant Williams.
Kelvin, hi, thanks for coming on. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, hi, Grant.
So listen, let's get straight into it, because you and I have had various conversations around sport and everything to do with it many times. And I know that your style is very much to the point. So I'm going to kick off with something that I think is close to your heart and close to everybody's heart. What the hell is going on with Charlton and all these owners and all these charlatans? And how does that make you feel as somebody that's been a season ticket holder for about 40 years?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I think it's about 24 years. And before that, I did 30 years with Millwall. So I'm one of those horrible people who actually move on from clubs. And I am, at the moment, so it's a good moment that we talk, I have just taken a season ticket at Brentford. Not entirely to do with the shambles at Charlton, which I'll talk about in a second, but also to do with the fact that Charlton's a 130-mile round trip for me, and it's only 25-mile round trip to Brentford, which at least has a new stadium. And I'm not going there to watch Premiership footballer. In a funny way,
I bloody right you're not after tonight. I have to tell you.
Well, this is the issue. I'd rather actually I'd watch some Championship. And then perhaps the holy grail of the Premiership was further on somewhere. But let's just talk about Charlton. So we had three owners in a year. Thanks to Lee Bowyer, he got a tune out of that team, which I do not believe any other manager in the land would have done. By and large, they were average to poor footballers, with the exception of Lyle Taylor. But he managed to create a teamwork that kind of worked. Then the following happened, as you know. Lyle Taylor has a contract to the end of June. So when we came out of lockdown, he then turned around and said, I know I've got a contract, and I know that the fans love me, because actually I scored 11 goals, but they love me for my endeavour and the fact that I run around a lot. But actually, you lot can get stuffed, even though I know that you have nobody who can score goals anymore. So my decision, I know, and apparently he had sleepless nights about it, I know that you're going to go down because of my decision. And he refused to play. He claimed that the situation was this, that he had the opportunity perhaps of going somewhere else because his contract was ending, and he didn't wish to pull a hamstring or injure himself in any way in case that then put him off. Now, that ended his ambition. Right. So he couldn't give a stuff about us, even although the fans really did warm to him. And he knew he was actually putting our club in some peril. Now, I can all understand all this, right? I didn't understand it. I hated him for it. I hoped he would break his leg while walking a dog or something like that. I really did not like him. And then Lee Bowyer, finally, in an interview, which I find bizarre, said he understood his position. Why did he say that? Why did he say that? The fans are the equity of a club. No club can survive. Its ownership can't, its manager can't, its players can't, without the equity, the fans, being by and large either neutral or positive. Once they become hostile, it becomes impossible. Why did Lee Bowyer say that? And I suspect Lee Bowyer said that because, honestly, Lee Bowyer is a very fine manager. He is going to move on himself. There will be a fistful of clubs, quite rightly, who will probably pay him more, make him more famous. I am not critical of his managerial ability. I am critical of the fact that he could understand that position. Why didn't he say, I don't care whether both my legs fell off. I don't care what happened to me. I'm going to fight to the death, A, because I'm being paid to do so, and B, because I absolutely don't agree with that kind of action. Why didn't he say that?
No, I'll tell you why I didn't say it, Kevin, because I don't think it's right. You know, let me push back on you a little bit. This is a young man who is out of contract.
Not a young man, Roger.
Well, compared to us, yes. Okay, but even more reason, given his age, then, to worry about his last payday contract. And he is being asked to risk that for a collection of charlatans and fly-by-nights who one day own the club and the next morning don't, and who aren't paying anything in for his wages, from what I understand. Why should this guy do that? Just because he's got the relate? This is the problem with football. The idea of loyalties all seem to go one way. And I think that guy doesn't own any loyalty to that ownership of the club.
Well, he may not own the loyalty to the ownership of the club, but I think you'd be the first to accept, Roger, that the equity, the pain, and actually the money, bizarrely, by and large, comes from the fans. Certainly the loyalty and the equity. And so he does owe us something. I think he owes us something. And if everybody in life took that view, that there was a greater calling than the people who are paying his wages, then obviously none of us have a chance in life. Look, I took it as a disloyal act, and it damaged my umbilical cord to Charlton. I mean, I've seen great managers, great teams. I mean, very interestingly, Kerbishley, for instance, created great players out of average players. It was astonishing to see a team like Charlton lining up against Manchester United with David Beckham in the side. These are moments that you're never probably likely to replicate in the short term anyway. But the Lyle Taylor episode, I'm afraid, I know you shouldn't be disappointed by football because there's always a new low, but that one really damaged me.
Kelvin, can I ask you, because when you started talking there before we got into the whole Lyle business, I was going to ask you this, but what you've said has actually just strengthened my curiosity. And that is, I'm interested in what made you kind of switch allegiances from Millwall to Charlton, because it's, and this is not judgmental on my part in any means, I've been a Fulham fan since I was 5 years old,
right?
And I can't imagine that loyalty ever going somewhere else. So it's interesting that I mean, I get people move and they move, but that kind of first club is always with you. And I'm just interested because when we talk about loyalty to the fans, it always used to be that your club was your club for life. And that has changed now with the amount of media profile that players get, and people follow players.
I agree with that. I mean, the funniest chant I ever heard was in League One, must be about four seasons back, in which they began chanting "I'm Scunthorpe till I die," and I did have to reflect on the lack of ambition there, I thought. But anyway, any Scunthorpe listeners, I apologise in advance. My question is: it's difficult to actually pinpoint it. But there was some violence down at Millwall during a very poor time at Millwall.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, it was really beyond anything. There were Millwall fans charging police horses on the pitch. I think it was a derby. I think it was a game against Derby. I think. Anyway, I just thought to myself, do you know what? I don't need this. And I went to Charlton, which I found a lot more family orientated. Yep. Now, things may have changed. But at that time, I just thought, you know, I just wanted to go somewhere else. My daughter used to come along, not to the Millwall games, but to the Charlton games. And I'm not sure that would have been possible at Millwall. But, you know, I mean, the truth is that I am a fly-by-night. The idea that I'm now might be going to Brentford, will be going to Brentford to watch them, as well as keeping my Charlton season ticket going. I love my football. I like watching football. I don't always live in the same house. Why should I always belong to the same football team? Yes, if you were a Manchester United supporter or something like that, I can understand that lasting with you forever. But if you're a local football supporter, do you have to stay with the same club forever? I'm not sure you do. Now, of course, I know that that will get me an absolute bucket load. But you know what?
You're used to that.
In fact, I've got medals for it. You're right.
No, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think of it the other way around. I always think of, you get these guys who are Man United fans who've never been within 100 miles of Old Trafford, but they're, you know, in their eyes, hardcore Man United fans. And it always seems to me, as growing up as a Fulham fan, that it was a real allegiance, because it was a small club, because there was no glamour involved with it, because it was, you know, wooden seats and losing 5-0 to Carlisle on a wet Wednesday night. It was kind of, there was something about it. But I think it just shows you how the age of TV, and I'm sure we'll get onto that, has changed, you know, the supporting of football clubs as well. Because I totally understand the love of football and wanting to have a local club to go and watch. So I find this very, very interesting.
Well, when you say that, it'd be interesting to see the reaction to your podcast, because by and large, when anybody says anything like this, at least a couple of things happen. The Brentford fans will say, "We don't want you, you bloody pot chaser. You didn't even know where bloody Brentford was." And I went down to Brentford's old ground, not their new one, a few seasons back when Charlton played them. And we were under a corrugated tin roof, right? And honestly, if you didn't bring along your own flask of tea, you weren't going to get any kind of any kind of reception at all. So, look, I agree. So, if people want to start chanting, the Charlton fans won't be pleased. You know, rat leaving the sinking ship. But
yeah,
the way
Charlton
exactly. has treated us, the fans, is beyond shocking.
Kelvin, let me come back a little bit to the context and the environment that we're talking about here. The EFL, we've mentioned your club, who has had a myriad of owners in the last little while, Bury, the utter shambles of Wigan, Sheffield Wednesday, which, you know, you've still got the thing going with the relegation. Here's a provocative one for you. The creation of the Premiership, making such a chasm between that and the EFL, has meant that, you know, relegation is a disaster financially, which means people have to speculate to not go down and then try and get up. And what you're left with is completely different from the football that we all grew up with in the 70s, where, you know, has it been a great thing when you look at this, the carnage around us today, that football has polarized around those 20 clubs that happen to be in the Premiership?
Yes, I mean, I think it, by and large, the entertainment factor has gone up and down. If I looked about it in relation to Charlton, one of the issues that has emerged there is that when you see 11 players on the pitch for the first time, you know, mid-August, late August, you actually don't know where they all came from. So you literally have to ask your colleague to your right, who always seems to know quite a lot. He may even bought a program, which is a rather strange thing to do these days. And then he says, oh, he used to play for Motherwell, or he's Lithuanian. He's in the Lithuanian under-21s. You didn't even know that Lithuania had 21 players, you know. So you are completely detached. And those players, if you looked at the end of the season, at least half of them have disappeared and have been replaced from other people that you didn't know about. So there is a detachment from the team, unless there's some genius like a Lyle Taylor who seems to be able to bang the ball in the back of the net and run around with them. Now, then you look at, strangely, you look at the Premiership, and that is not true. Those 11 players, or those 14 players on the bench, or shortly to become potentially 16 players overall, you do know them. And it's a bit like saying, I really like Beyonce. You know, you can identify with those players. So I actually think the Premiership has been a strength for the fan base. I mean, you try and get into, you know, Grant, you're a Fulham fan.
Yes, indeed.
You can go to Fulham, right? If I wanted to pay my money, I can get into Fulham most Saturdays. Have you tried getting into Chelsea? I mean, you know, these major clubs are sold out.
Yeah.
So they are doing something right. They're getting deep, big television audiences, and they're selling out to the fans. So I think what they're offering is they're offering consistency of product, consistency of people, and the fans do feel part of them. So I part company with you on that project.
Yeah, okay, but you know, you need to be in the Premiership. In our day, you know, if you were in the old Division Two, let's take the example of Brian Clough and Nottingham Forest. Yeah. You know, that can't happen anymore. And these days, you wouldn't even have the chance of it, because Nottingham Forest would have sold its stadium to some charlatan from fucking who knows where. And, you know, like, nobody's paying the wages. And surely, when you think that football, and you know this well, is such a cultural part of the United Kingdom, and I'm going to come on, you know what I'm going to come on to now in Newcastle, it's not right that we have a laissez-faire attitude and just say, sort it out, boys. You know, there's there's the promised land of the Premiership. I'm sure you'll get there. And if you don't, too bad. Surely we can do better than that, Kelvin.
Well, I don't know what the choice is, because is your choice to go over to the American system, have a kind of closed unit group, and you have franchises? I actually prefer the idea of the ups and the downs at the end of the season. Often relegation is more interesting than the top two.
I agree with that. I agree.
And on that basis, you're going to have winners and losers, and it's the winners and losers which make it such an attractive proposition for foreign investors. So what I can't understand about Newcastle is that they have turned the Premier League, apparently we're going to turn them down before they bail. What I can't understand about that is the Saudis may not be a great example of human rights. When I last looked, I would describe Russia as a natural home for Mother Teresa. Nor would I have described China or perhaps the odd Italian who might have question marks against his background. Why the Saudis were not allowed, and remember, towns and cities of this country are defined uniquely by how well their football club is doing. So Newcastle, we don't hear a lot about it. We're going to go into a difficult time now. Many people in Newcastle may not be doing all that well, right? Suddenly the Saudis come in, and suddenly, unbelievably, Mbappe suddenly ends up playing for Newcastle. Suddenly they end up getting into UEFA. Suddenly they're in the top six. This is a club, this is a city that is defined by a club in the centre of its city. You know, what is it about Newcastle that makes it exceptional from when handing out whether the Saudis could buy it? What is it about Saudi Arabia? I mean, China. What is it about, you know, what about the Muslim groups in China? Doesn't that make them, trying to teach these Muslim groups to dance and sing in some kind of way?
Well, yeah, listen, I think I actually agree with your point on this, and I'll break it down for a couple of reasons. First of all, if I'm not mistaken, Saudi Arabia already has a club in England. They're called Sheffield United. I take your point on all the other, you know, are we going to get into some kind of like value league table about human rights? Because, you know, who decides that? But you know, more importantly, if you look at the real world, Kelvin, you know, in the banking world, the planes before COVID certainly were full of people going over to the Middle East to get money for their funds that they were raising, their private equity funds. And as you say, you know, unless you're going to be absolutely whiter than white, you have to have a view about selling arms to people like that and then the jobs that are related.
So, that's a good point, Roger. I mean, the bottom line is the Saudis, through our arms sales to them, employ thousands of people in our country, right? You know, we don't sell arms to Russia, or as far as I know, we don't. They want to sell arms to us, you know? I mean, we have got to decide, what are we? What are we? Are we open for business or we're not? And if we're open to business, the Saudis, they should be allowed to come in. Sure, you have to be a bit careful. I mean, you know, taking the knee may not be the only ambition of the Saudis, right? They might want to take your arm as well. But look, I think it's a problem, and I'd like to know what it was that the Premier League, I would like them to come out and say it, what it was that made the Newcastle deal not possible. What was it? I mean, you know what the Newcastle fans are saying? They're saying that the issue is Barclays sponsoring the Premier League and taking on Amanda Staveley in the High Court right now over the bailing out of Barclays.
Oh, really?
The money was raised. And now saying that it's because she represented the Saudis that Barclays put the arm on the Premier League. Look, I don't believe that.
I don't buy that. They don't have enough financial stake to do that.
Yeah, no,
the sponsor isn't that important.
I buy that, but this is what they say. I mean, if you're a fan, you know you believe in every conspiracy.
Yeah.
Kelvin, let me ask about this, and you're the perfect person for us to take this down this line, but let's talk about the role that the media has in creating this environment that you talk about. Because I look at this, I see both arguments. I can see why Newcastle fans would be upset. I can understand the reasons why this takeover is being blocked. But I think those reasons stem largely from media coverage and this world that we've built around ourselves, where the sort of public shaming that happens on anything. And it's hard to find any news anymore. Everything's really opinion. And so when something like this comes up, everyone's got an opinion on it. And generally speaking, if the opinion of the majority of the media, which let's face it, tend towards the left for the most part, is that the Saudis are bad, then it's amazing how quickly it becomes bad to agree with the takeover. Yeah. So I'm interested in the role media has played and how we've got here, really.
Well, one of the issues is that in some ways the media doesn't matter anymore. Social media definitely matters, right? Incredibly so. So mainstream media, which I've been associated with for most of my life, has started to head backwards because the sheer numbers aren't there. In my day, when I was editor of The Sun, we would sell four and a quarter million a day. It was incredible. If you multiplied by three, the number of people normally bought read a paper, you know, you were basically half the country was reading the paper.
Right.
And today that number is, say, 800,000. I mean, very unfair on the editor, but the sales have cratered because of COVID, because people aren't, A, going to work, and B, they're not even going down the shops anymore. They're being told by the government, stay where you are, ridiculously so, in my view. But, so, mainstream media doesn't have the power that it does, even allowing for the fact, however, that if you take something like Twitter is a left-wing vehicle in which not just it's not just a woke view, but a very virulent kind of Marxist view of society gains the greatest traction. However, you know, The Guardian then writes, saying, isn't it disgraceful? They're chopping people's arms off and God knows what in Saudi. And it is disgraceful, but there's lots of disgraceful things happening in this world. I mean, for instance, we're worrying about, correctly, one journalist, right? Absolutely shocking, beyond shocking, right? Well, what about the 20,000 that the NHS killed by sending out patients into old folks' homes and spreading the virus like a tsunami and just killing loads of people? Right, who may well have died anyway within a year or not, but they weren't given the choice. Boom. What about those 20,000? How do we keep on equating different forms of civilization and society together? I'm not sure. But anyway, if we look at it, the papers are not as important as they were. Funnily enough, what has happened is that the serious-minded papers have become, or the unpopulars, as I used to refer to them, have in fact become more powerful in one sense, that they carry in-depth views of their political wokedom. So if you're on The Guardian, normally three men and a cat would normally read it. Thanks to it being not behind a paywall, that number may multiply by tens of thousands. And so that view gets out more, and then it gets retweeted and republished, etc., like that. So I actually think papers like The Times and The Guardian are going to survive in ways that The Sun and The Daily Mirror will not survive, unfortunately. And because when I say won't survive, they won't survive in their current form. The printed form, the idea of cutting trees, shipping them from Finland over here, or remilling them, shipping them over here, and then printing them, and then putting them on a truck, and then send them back out again, just won't work. So, you know, we're going to see a world as we have done. I mean, the numbers have gone fantastically off the dial in terms of things like mail online or something during COVID that have gone up like 30 and 40%. They've gone up in line with Amazon. So the power of the printed media is at an end, I'm afraid.
But Kelvin, how do you view how we got to this point? Because it seems to me that the media has changed dramatically over the last 15, 20 years, I guess, since the turn of the century. It seems to have changed dramatically.
Yeah.
So when you look back as a career media guy, I mean, you understand this business as well as anybody. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of view that journey? And what do you think the pressures that have been brought to bear? And how have we kind of come through this evolution?
Well, when you don't have to pay for something and you can get the news on your phone, why on earth would you go down to, why would you employ a paper girl, and clock up a bill, which has to be paid at some stage, when you can effectively get what you need to know on your phone? It's a matter of simplicity. I mean, it's the same issue. It's the same issue which the supermarkets are facing. I mean, you know, Waitrose are doing very well. It's all going rather nicely. And then suddenly, Ocado then go and do a deal with M&S. So that's them in the market. And the next thing that happens is that Amazon then have their fresh product. So that's it. If I'm Waitrose, you know what I'm doing? I'm not bothering trying to save my business. I'm going to flog it 100 miles an hour. There's just change coming at you all the time. And it's all tech related. So the thing I can't understand, for instance, with football, is why that they still believe that fans should pay to take the whole of the game rather than an individual, the whole of the Premier League rather than an individual game. But the best win in the world, I couldn't care less what the result is of the Burnley Crystal Palace game. Even once I know what the game is, I couldn't care less. Okay? However, if I wanted to see, I don't know, Manchester City play Chelsea or something like that, I might well pay for it. Why do I have to have, and this is a question which I suspect will become increasingly the case, why do I have to pay for the whole of the league when I only want certain games? Roger?
Well, I mean, Kelvin, the answer is very simple. It's called bundling. You know, like,
I know it is. I know what it's called.
It's the old LP thing. You never let the customer just buy exactly what they want. You need to add in something else, otherwise it's not as attractive. You know, I at my time with Vic Wakeling at Sky, we actually did one of the first pay-per-view trials in my league because I wanted to really investigate that. Yeah. And the answer they came back with, they said, well, look, you know, we don't want to go down this route because it doesn't make sense for us. The pay model is much more interesting than being able to unbundle things. That's almost the kind of like, oh my God, let's make sure that never happens. Let's try everything to make sure that never happens, because the polarization at that point just rips the whole thing apart.
You say that, Rob. Now, it may be that the other clubs have to fund the poorer partners to keep them in the game. I do understand that, right?
Yeah, but the pie's smaller, Kelvin. It's not a distribution thing. The pie's smaller. If you add up all the pay-per-views by club, it's not going to be as big as So that's the answer. It's getting people to buy for things that they don't want. But this takes me on to what I think is something we want to talk about a little bit now. Your mate, your man, Rupert, basically at the start of the 90s, stumbled across this model of pay television and dominated it. And it's without doubt that he has been the global financier of sport for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
The model he came up with was genius for the reason I've said. It's exactly that. It's getting people to pay for lacrosse when all they really want to see is Man United games. It's genius. Technology, as you say, is ripping that apart. But in a week when, or in a year when Sky is sold to Comcast, when Barney Francis is gone, Vic's dead, Scudamore's gone. How do you summarize the Rupert years? Let's keep it, well, if not necessarily in sport, up to you, when you've got his son seemingly wanting to distance himself from what I think has been, the absolute bank of sport for the last 30 years. Why does his son feel at this point he needs to say, I'm not with you anymore?
Yeah.
Surely.
Well, it's an absolute disgrace, a total disgrace by James Murdoch. His father, recognizing he had health issues, underlying health issues as they're now known, a few years back, must be 8-9 years ago, stuck all his shares, distributed all the shares to his family through the state of Nevada and gifted them. So after 7 years, those shares were tax free. Right? So they each pick up $2 billion each, which is, by the way, Personally, I've never come across any money like that. I don't think that's a good thing for anybody. Actually, completely not a good thing. I didn't notice James Murdoch sent the money back. The reason he got $2 billion is because his father turned out to be, and by the way, his father's a pretty decent guy, right? Loner. If I had his pressures, I'd be even more mad than I am already. I don't know how he can deal with those kind of employing 30,000 people across five continents. It's an amazing performance, right? And he's done stunningly well. He's turned capitalism absolutely to his advantage, and well done him. He did what any retailer would do. He gave people what they wanted. And so, James, whether he agreed with this or he didn't agree with it, it's absolutely inconsequential. Rupert made the bet. This is what we're going to do. Finally, now Rupert's 90, and that the company, three quarters of the company, has been half sold. Although you've got to say, with Fox making $1 billion a year, and when Trump goes, a right-wing news operation will be more powerful.
Sure.
Because they'll be out of office. The idea that Fox News be attacking Biden every day, can you imagine what fantastic television that's going to be? The audience is going to go up, not down, when Trump goes. It's a misunderstanding of the market. So if James felt badly about it, why didn't he do this? Why didn't he do this? I want to thank my dad for every opportunity he gave me, because I recognize I got those top jobs, not because my name is James, but because my name's Murdoch. I'd never have got those opportunities in any other sphere. Thank you for training me up. Thank you for the money, Dad. And good luck to you with your next ventures. Why didn't he say that? Instead of that, he has to say, I disagree with this, I disagree with that. Well, when he runs a business, literally from a local paper in Adelaide, and turns out he can sell half of it or 60% of it for $58 billion, some 50 years, 60 years later, then he can have a say in the debate. Beyond that, I'd be very obliged, to take Attlee, be grateful for a period of silence. It's an absolute disgrace, the man.
Yeah, But do you not think it's a little bit like end of an era?
Yeah.
Like I said before, you know, I think, you know, because I lived it, the whole professionalization of the game and the money that came into it and the haves and the have-nots and how you try and manage that. Something, by the way, which I think Scudamore did really well, and people don't realize the influence he had quite quietly. I think, you know, the Newcastle thing, if Scudamore had still been there, would have been ended up quite differently.
How do you think would have ended up?
They would have bought the club.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm.
And it would have been coming around, you know, the narrative would have been, you know, this is exactly your narrative. You know, this is a region that needs this. We're going to support it. We are going to make them understand that what they have done with piracy is not the way they do it. We do it. And we'll educate them a little bit. He would have turned it around and helped them actually get some of the rejectors out of it. The point I'm making is I sense that for a million reasons, the 92 to 2000 era of sport and football, if we call it football, that was more or less prosperous and for the good of everybody, has come to an end. And I think we are in the start of a shit show that I'm not sure how we're going to control it, Kelvin.
How do you see? What do you mean you could see less revenues into the game?
I think there's going to be polarization into what are basically the lifestyle brands, you know, those big clubs that will probably go for some kind of American style Super League that will be packaged as entertainment more than competitive sport. The rest of the rest of the game will be poorer. There'll be new models that need to try to be found, and then with that you will have new money coming into it who I don't think will understand the sensitivities that I think all of us hold dear. You know, most of the people that I know of my generation that like me grew up in these last 30 years, all of us still feel a sense that Bristol City is important, that Charlton is important, that Celtic and Rangers are important. I'm not sure that the new money understands that.
Yes, I agree. Do you see more American ownership?
Well, I think more fund ownership. Whether those funds are American, that's likely, yes. But I tell you something, Kelvin, see this thing about the Man City UEFA overturning financial fair play, that makes football a much less investable asset. You know, the reason they all came in the last 5 years was because the wages were under control and there was some element of profitability and cash flow. I think the Man City decision throws that right out. I agree with Mourinho. I think all bets are off now, and you'll see the fund guys that need to do it on a financial model. They're going to say, we can't deal with this and we can't deal with relegation.
Do you see Spurs heading for the door?
What do you mean, going towards a Super League?
No, being sold.
Yeah, I think there's been rumours for a while that if he could get his money, he would take it. You know, where else are they going to go now? You know, like they've got the new stadium. Daniel Levy doesn't seem to want to spend the money that's needed to keep the players that his direct competitors aspire to. So I don't see them winning the Premiership. So, you know, this is probably peak, as you say, about Waitrose. I would be a seller if I was Tottenham now.
And would you be a seller? Right. So I am a massive, massive fan of Daniel Levy. I love the way that he nickel and dimes the deal itself.
The hardest negotiator I've ever come across. I tried to buy Vicenza Football Club off Enoch once.
Right.
And what he was asking is just like ridiculous.
Yeah.
I bet he does it with a straight face.
Yeah. He believes it. Do you know what his lawyer said to me? His lawyer said to me, he said, my advice to you, by the way, he was a horrible piece of work as well, right? No, I don't know if he was horrible, but he was as tough as old boots. He said to me, can I give you a piece of advice? I said, not particularly, but go on, if you're going to bore me. And he said, I should point out to you that Daniel used to sell ties to Indians off a store in London. I said, when you've done that, he said, you can sell anything. He's as tough as all boots. Ties to Indians, I can quite understand it, but I got the Jeff Drift a bit in it. And the whole of his life, but he's done the most phenomenal job for Spurs.
Phenomenal.
And you know, good luck to him.
I just wanted to ask you to reflect a little bit, you know, when we talk about this, because you were in the middle of this for a while. You know, you and I met for the first time when you came up to Scotland and you tried to buy the SPL rights.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the first time we hooked up and you exposed me to one of your epic BBC rants who were outbidding you at the time. Going back, what would you do different? Given that you've seen how the rights world has evolved, would you have done it differently and said to Rupert, look, give me a huge wad of cash and I'll blow everybody out of the water?
Well, by the way, that would have been a pretty short conversation had I said that. Hello? Have you gone fucking mad? No, I don't think I've had that conversation. No, I don't think so. I quite enjoyed it being small. I think it's almost, knowing my personality, I think it's almost impossible for me to run a bigger company. I admire these guys who can run big companies. I could not have run a big broadcasting company because I want to stick my oar into everything. And I like to know the people I work with really well. And I think, you know, I like the idea of being the pirate in the whole thing. You know, I like the idea. For instance, we invented the as you well know, Roger, we didn't have the rights to.
You were the first pirates. We were the first ones of the lot.
We used to put the sounds. So that sound system they now use, to make it sound as though that there's plenty of oohs and ahs going on during the COVID stadiums. I was doing this 20-odd years ago, and all I was getting was a bloody great big raspberry for it, right? And we went to court, and we won the battle to allow on free-to-air sports, we were allowed to do off the television broadcasting. And as long as we kept on saying, we don't have the rights for this, we're not in the stadium. And so it became a bit of a laugh, really. I think one of the issues, I think, I admire what they've done with TalkSport in one sense, is that they haven't changed it a lot. Reporting sports talk radio now is quite difficult because in a funny way, it all sounds the same. Nobody is prepared, really, to say anything which is going to rock the boat, really. You know, it's all about, I think Tom's not scoring many goals at the moment. What do you think, Arthur? No, he's not scoring many goals. I'll tell you what the owner should do. He should spend a lot more money on replacing him. Don't you think, Tom? Oh, yeah, I do. Honestly, there's only so much of that you can take. I think having Premiership rights, it's quite a good sound, and it made me laugh that ITV guy who got very upset because ITV replaced him.
Yeah, Tilsley
with a younger model. That made me laugh. That, I mean, after all, how difficult is it to commentate on a game? You know, Harry Kane's got the ball and he's passed the ball to somebody else, and they have passed the ball to somebody wearing their own shirt. And no, they've lost the ball now, and they're now having. I mean, how difficult is it? It's a bit like being a newscaster. And here is the 10 o'clock news. And they're reading, the Prime Minister has said X, and some bloke. I think it is, by the way, that everybody is a professor. Have you noticed everybody's a professor now? Everybody's a professor, and everybody seems to be in the virology business or the epidemiology business. Did you know any of these businesses existed? Did you know there were so many professors out there?
Kelvin, let me ask you a question about media in general, because I was interested by something you said there about TalkSport at the beginning and how much you enjoyed it being small. Do you think the age of scale in media is anywhere near its apogee? Do you think at some point there is going to be a move back to smaller, more local businesses, because obviously people are struggling financially? And is that a way we're going to go, or do we still have a lot more of this consolidation and gigantic media corporations to come?
More consolidation, I'm afraid. Scale, the small-time entrepreneur selling out. Media buyers don't want to deal with small companies. They want to deal with big companies because that helps them as well. Because the scale of the deals, you know, the media buying deals, you know, for television and radio and all the rest of it, I'm afraid it's more, not less. And, you know, hopefully in the radio business, News Corporation decide to expand their interest and therefore compete. Unfortunately, print is not in good shape, and I can't see that surviving. But I could. But Lachlan Murdoch, by the way, is a good guy, and yep. he cleverly bought the Daily Mail radio assets quite a long time ago and stuck them in his private company, and they've been tremendous cash cows. He also, when the equivalent of Australia's Right Move was going bust, he persuaded his dad to put $5 million Australian into it, which is basically 3 9, and the thing today is worth many billions. He has made some good bets. He's made some bad bets. In business, Roger, you know this. Everybody knows this. It is that you're placing bets all the time. They're not always going to be winning bets. They are not going to be winning bets. There's lots of losers out there. In the media, though, I'm afraid social media is all the growth. And that is going to be paid. That's where all the money is. That's where all the money is. You know, I mean, I think 80% of the advertising now goes into that kind of advertising, goes into places like Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, they take it all. Google and Facebook take it all.
It's small. The rest of it is small beer, and the numbers are so small. The numbers are so small. I admire Mail Online. They've had a good go. I think the Sun Online could be better. But Guardian, while it remains free, there's a lot of lefties out there who want to hate anybody who's got a 3-bedroom detached house in Croydon. So each one is doing its best. But let
me ask you, Kelvin, because I think this is the one of the questions, at least for me, of the generation or the period that you have seen. You know, a lot of people will say the role of the media isn't always, just as you said, to give the people what they want. For business, that maybe is the case, but there is an obligation to try and take them to a better place. I think I probably know the answer to this, but you know, you must have thought about this a bit. Do you just go down to where you think you can sell to the people, or do you think there is an obligation to try and do something better?
There are different aspects to that question. If you're saying on the politics, I think you should have a view, whether it's left or right, you should definitely have a view, right? If you say that it's a vehicle in which you're trying to, in what the BBC, which Reith said, our job is to inform and entertain. I absolutely don't agree with that. I don't agree with the inform aspect of it. And entertainment is serving. I do agree with serving your listener or your viewer or your reader. I do agree with that. But what does inform mean? You know, we all of us need informing and educating all the time. But I don't consider the media's job is to do that. Having said that, if you read a paper like the New York Times, they have some stunning stuff in there. And the Wall Street Journal leaves the Financial Times absolutely for dead. Phenomenal piece of journalism. But you have to decide, yes, I want to be informed. I'm therefore prepared to pay money for the subscription or the paper or something like that. So there are people that do that. I mean, some of the, as I coming back to my previous argument, the upscale is going to survive in a subscription world. And funnily enough, the world that I knew, Sun, The Mirror, even the Daily Express and all that, I'm afraid they're going to go by the wayside.
Yeah.
Kelvin, let me ask you to switch to journalists as opposed to journalism and just talk about what in your mind makes a good sports journalist. And I'd love to get your thoughts on some of the greats that you've maybe worked with or admired back in the day and what you think the current state is.
Honestly, you'd be asking the wrong guy about great sports journalists. You know, I'm not an expert on it. What I do know is that the quality has actually gone up, not down.
Interesting.
Definitely, 100%. There are. I don't know. There are probably, you know, a dozen Henry Winters out there now. You know, and the reason for that, and where the Sun has fallen way behind. Is that it hasn't got that kind of quality. The great thing about the sports fan is the sports fan may not give a tuppenny damn who the foreign secretary is, nor particularly care about what's happening in Poland or China or something like that. They do know about their sport, and they do enjoy both the historical aspect of sport as well as the match that happened yesterday. And the heavyweight papers, particularly the Times, by the way, to a lesser extent, the Guardian, but although the Guardian's good at it, have embraced this, and their product is 10 times better. If I were the Sun, I would simply take the great pieces that appear in the Times, I've edited them slightly, and stick them in the Sun, right? There are no ifs and buts about it. It's one of the few places, whereas the Sun, you know, is best at, you know, a couple of hundred words, bit back, you know, right. The Times has done the reverse, and they're the same company, and I'd just come to some agreement between everybody to improve it. So that would be my advice.
So who do you not like these days is around sports content? Who do you say you don't have a strong opinion about who's good, but I'm sure you've got a big opinion about who's not doing it the way you'd do it.
Look, I'm a big fan of what the Times does. Okay, I also think that the Daily Telegraph is up their game under their editor. I think it better. I think the Financial Times is absolute tosh, but of course that doesn't cover sport really. And yet they should do in detail.
They do a little bit now. They've got a couple of guys that dedicated to it. They're doing business of football, business of sports stuff.
Okay, well, you probably know better than I do. I stopped reading them because actually they're the guys that used to say, do you remember, you should vote Labour. How on earth could you have a financial paper, you know, that believes in capitalism with all its problems, saying vote Labour? How did that possible? How does anybody, that editor should have been slung out. And honestly, every so often he pops up giving his views. I find it incredible. Anyway, look, I don't know too much about that stuff, so it's probably not a very good area to go into for me.
All right, so listen, let's wrap it up. We've taken up too much of your time, but okay. I do want to end with an anecdote that I will always remember that I read in your book about the your horoscope journalist.
Yep.
Who, if I'm not mistaken, Kelvin, you had decided that her time had ended in your employ.
Yeah.
And you wrote her a letter that started with the famous phrase, as you will have no doubt foreseen, this is your last day. Yeah.
Do you know about that? Do you know what about that? No, this is how mad I was. Nobody ever said to me, you know, you shouldn't bother with that. No, you know, it's... You know, do you know what I mean?
You've never listened to anybody, let's be honest.
Yeah, I have become quite balmy, right? Quite balmy. And it's only when you go into business where you have to show, you know, you have to you know, bow at the knee, you know, that you realize that you've gone completely crackers. And but anyway, look, they were great times. We were successful commercially. And give Rupert his credit. Now, Rupert is a, you know, in his own interest, absolutely, but it doesn't matter about that. He has stood by the sun through good times and bad. And at the end of it all, he's now losing 30, 40 million a year, okay? He's dropped a, I said to him, Munch, you must have dropped a billion on the Times, and he said, at least that, okay?
Jeez.
Who else do you know in the world, who would have dropped this kind of money? So he's now losing the money. He's probably losing $60 million a year on the New York Post. God knows what he's losing in Australia, where the whole thing is a disaster. The Sun is losing, you know, 30, 40 million a year. These are catastrophes, but he loves his print and he's standing by it. He doesn't get any credit for it because there's a bunch of tossers on Twitter who decided that he's Beelzebub. But I tell you what, when he goes and the Sun turns up one day and the CFO goes up to Lachlan and says, have you seen this? And he shows him last month's management accounts, which will be horrendous. And Lachlan will have to face the prospect. What do I do? I gave my dad an assurance that I wouldn't fold them. But dad didn't know that I was going to lose £6 million in February. What can I do? And that will be a judgment. And I wouldn't like to make that judgment if I were Lachlan.
Well, it's interesting. I think in this day and age, the cost of having your own platform, the size and width that the Murdochs have, I would think is absolutely a hell of a loss leader. I think I wouldn't mind throwing a few $100 million at someone like that to have that platform and to have it completely under your thrall in a time like this. I suspect is probably not a bad investment for the Murdochs. I mean, I don't know, but just
I don't quite understand that, Grant. On what basis?
I'm just saying to have a media platform that can put out whatever you need it to put out and have an opinion.
You mean for influence and power?
Yeah, absolutely.
And all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, right. Okay. I absolutely take you on about that. So the current band is selling, say, $4.25 million a year. Honestly, I've got the Chancellor ringing me up asking what I thought of the budget. Right. I've got one GCSE and I failed it when I tried to take all the GCSEs again. Right. So I had 17 attempts and I got one GCSE. The idea that the Chancellor of our country is ringing me up asking what I thought of his budget struck me as absolutely ridiculous until I realized that he really wasn't asking me. He was asking Rupert, right? I was just a cipher in all this. That conversation does not take place when you sell 800,000 a day, right? 700,000 or 600,000 or 500,000. So I say that moment has come and gone, and that the investment, the losses, are not worth any kind of help that number 10 may be able to give you. Or it's the White House
politicians,
or Australia. I honestly don't believe it. But look, I hope you're right, because if you are right, then journalists are going to stay in work for many, many years, and I'm in favour of that.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see.
I'm sorry, guys, I have got to go.
No problem.
Yeah, we're done, mate.
Okay,
listen,
thank you so much. Cheers, guys.
Kelvin. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Cheers, bye.
Yeah, I've got to say, Rog, for me, having your own media platform today is, when it's part of a massive multi-billion-dollar conglomerate like News Corporation, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing throwing a few million down the drain to have access to that kind of platform.
Yeah, I don't know, because, like, you know, you see elections been decided now on social media, with all these fancy companies that can manipulate algorithms. And if you remember, Grant, Neil Kinnock, I think, said the Sun won it, for John Major when Kelvin did that headline, you know, the last person to leave the UK,
put out the lights.
I agree with him. I don't think they've got that power anymore.
Maybe they don't. But if youngsters
don't buy the papers and they've got the vote grant.
No, true. You know, but look, it's not. I wasn't talking about newspaper. I'm talking about media. I'm talking about having a media platform that goes from print across social media to movies to TV to everything. Right. That's basically what News Corp has. And don't forget, they bought MySpace. Do you remember that?
They tried.
They just picked the wrong horse, unfortunately. They tried to get in there. But you know, I think if you're a high-profile guy like Murdoch, with the times that I suspect are coming for high-profile people, I wouldn't mind having a means to get my story out there and influence the opinions of hundreds of millions of people favourably towards me if the time we should ever arrive running.
No, I hear you. So what did you think, Grant, of that hour there?
Well, it's very interesting, Rog. You know, it's obviously media is such an important part of the sporting landscape. I did find it very interesting that bit we go into at the beginning where Kelvin, because it's clear he loves his football, right? You don't get that animated about the Lyle Taylor situation if you don't love your football and you don't love your club. But I'm really interested in this idea of being able to switch clubs. I just couldn't do it. You know, I just don't know how that's possible. So I found that very, very interesting, I have to say.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, listen, Kelvin's a bit of a broke the mold with him,
and
as we said at the start or before he came on, you know, everybody can have their own views. I think that my own opinion is that I got to know him a little bit over these years. I found him incredibly smart. He is very opinionated. He is incredibly laissez-faire. He believes that the world is there, that you earn your way or you don't cry. It's a lot of people don't like that. He's made mistakes. But, you know, I think that he was a talent of his generation, and a generation that was dominated by certainly one media mogul, two if you include Maxwell in this country, in the UK. And he was in the front row seat. You know, he told me stories times, you know, that he would call up, never mind the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he would call up John Major and say, I'm just giving you a bit of a heads up, mate, tomorrow morning I'm going to dump a pile of shit all over your head on my front page. Have a great evening and put the phone down. I mean, that was the world he lived in. Now, that goes to your head, I think, in some cases. It's very difficult to not be influenced by that, Grant.
Well, it's what I find fascinating, Rog, is in an age where social media has given everybody the ability to voice their opinion, and everybody takes that and stretches it to the max and is dogmatic and fixed in their opinions and has an opinion about everything. It's interesting to me that you would think that people like Kelvin, who do have an opinion and have always had an opinion, would actually be more appreciated now than they were before. But it seems to be that he's just a lightning rod for criticism anytime he opens his mouth. And maybe that's just because of this whole polarization we've spoken about before.
Yeah, like I say, he believes in a certain political ethos of, as I said before, laissez-faire, you get on with it. You know, the world's a Darwinian world. It's not got any socialist ideas of he is what he is, you know, and he's taken that through the good times and the bad times. And I think, you know, the fact is he admitted there, you know, being opinionated, we've talked about this a lot, Grant, whether it's about Eddie Pepperell or even ourselves, you know, there's a time when it's not smart to have the opinion. You know, it's better just to keep quiet because it's just not the moment in society. I think he's never embraced that way of looking at things.
I think we
said at the start we weren't going to get into it, but you know, when you are dealing in a newsroom, a competitive newsroom, and, you know, you've got a hint of a story, never mind the famous one. Let's think it's, you know, Elton John. It was another famous one he got wrong, I think. You know, and, you know, you have to make a decision at one point. Am I going to go with this or not? you know? And that's the famous phrase, publish and be damned.
Yeah.
You know, that must do a lot to your psyche, that kind of like binary, am I going to run with this? Because, you know, I don't think, I certainly have never been in that kind of like high profile, this could work or it could be a disaster type, you know, split decision making. So it must be very difficult. I always try and look to people and say, well, okay, many people make mistakes. We all make mistakes. What was the circumstances that led up to them? And, you know, I think I can imagine that high pressure, split second, are we going with it or not? And, you know, he's certainly got that wrong on a couple of high profile occasions.
Yeah, I think back in the day, that decision was based around how will it play. And for a lot of people, that decision now is based around what will the reaction be, which is a shame. You know, it's a shame. Kelvin's not like that. His benchmark for choosing whether he'd go with it or not is should I go with it, not what are people going to say. And frankly, God bless him. I think if we could do with a few more people that just said what they felt and weren't that worried about the reaction, because if you worry about reaction today, you're in trouble, because there is always going to be a reaction. There's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Rog, another delightful week. Hopefully we can tow our absent pirate out of the Solent in time for next time.
Isn't that ridiculous? All this about going round the Cape of Good Hope.
Just one.
And he's in the fucking Solent Bay.
God bless him. Bless him.
What a guy. What a guy.
All that remains is to thank you, our listeners, for sticking with us, for listening to us, for rating and reviewing the podcast, for sharing it with your friends, all those good things that we ask you to do every week. We are immensely grateful to each and every one of you. Please do follow us on Twitter if you don't already. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's the word, A-R-E. And you can follow me at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, off to the lake with you, my friend. I'll see you next time.
Thank you. Take care, Grant.